I lay helpless. He aimed the barrel of his revolver at my head. Our eyes met. They were Henry's eyes. Sic semper tyrann. The last word was cut off by the sound of the shot. Abe awoke with a start. He sat straight up in his bed and shielded his face with his hands, just as he had all those years ago, on the night he saw his father dealing with the devil, the night Jack Bartz had condemned his mother to death. Mary slept peacefully by his side. His boys were safely in their beds. A thorough check of the house turned up no evidence of trespassers, living or otherwise. Still, Abe would sleep no more that February night. There'd been something so familiar about the dream, so real. He could see every detail of the theater in his mind, every detail of the costumes and scenery. He could feel the nauseating pain of his leg and hear Angelina's blood running onto the floor. But try as he might, Abe couldn't remember those three damned words that his murderer uttered just before he woke. Footnote: Angelina Lehman actually did die 2 months after Abe's dream. Her cause of death remains unknown. It's doubtful that vampires were involved. Shortly after Abe's dream, William Seward, still the heavy favorite to be the Republican presidential nominee in 1860, made a strange tactical decision. Seward has abruptly left for a tour of Europe, and shall be gone these next 6 months at least. What can it mean on the eve of so crucial an election? How can such an absence be to his advantage? There are many who have criticized the trip as proof of his arrogance, his aloofness. I, however, am reluctant to levy such condemnation, for I suspect that he has been sent at the Union's behest. Abe's suspicion was confirmed by Henry's next letter. Abraham, our friend S. has been sent on an errand, one which we hope will shore up support for our cause in the coming months and years. We now ask that you turn your whole heart toward that greatest of political contests. H. In Seward's absence, Abe's political allies worked to shore up support for a presidential run, while Abe worked on raising his national awareness. On the evening of February 27, 1860, at New York's Cooper Institute, he delivered what some historians consider to be the greatest political speech of all time to an audience of more than 1,000. "Neither let us be slandered from our duty by false accusations against us," Abe shouted, "nor frightened from it by menaces of destruction to the government, nor of dungeons to ourselves. Let us have faith that right makes might, and in that faith let us, to the end, dare to do our duty as we understand it." The full text ran in every major New York newspaper the next day, and within a couple of weeks, pamphlets containing Lincoln's Cooper speech were available throughout the North. Abe was emerging as the intellectual leader of the Republican Party and its most gifted speaker. The Democratic Party, meanwhile, had been split in two. Northern Democrats nominated Abe's old rival Stephen Douglas for president, while Southerners picked the incumbent vice president, John C. Breckinridge. The fracture was no accident. Rather, it was the result of a decades-long effort by the Union. Since the early 19th century, Henry and his allies had worked to undermine their enemies at every turn, ferrying slaves to the North on the Underground Railroad, dispatching spies across the South, and, more recently, discouraging secessionist talk in state legislatures. But their greatest achievement came on May 18, 1860, on the third ballot of the Republican National Convention in Chicago. Abe was in Springfield when he learned that he, not Seward, had been nominated for president. "I can scarcely comprehend that such an honor has been bestowed upon me. And yet, and there is no hope of putting this modestly, so I shall not attempt to, it comes as no surprise. There is a war coming. It shall not be a war of man, but it is man who shall spill his blood fighting it. for it concerns his very right to be free, and I, of all men, must win it. In 1860, presidential candidates weren't expected to campaign on their own behalf. The speech-making and handshaking were traditionally left to political allies and subordinates, while the candidates themselves remained behind the scenes, quietly writing letters and greeting well-wishers. Abe saw no reason to break with tradition. While his supporters, including Seward, who, despite losing the nomination, threw his full weight behind Abe, tirelessly traveled the country on his behalf, candidate Lincoln remained with his family in Springfield. From an entry dated April 16th, "I walk to and from my office each morning, greeting friends as I pass, thanking strangers for their good wishes. When my business is concluded, I gamble about with my two youngest at home before seeing them off to bed, and when the weather is suitable, I join Mary for a walk. Life is much as it ever was, with three exceptions, those being the three vampires who have come to keep watch over us." Abe's swift-footed assailants had been reassigned by Henry and the Union. They were now his personal bodyguards, sworn to protect him at all costs. "I suspect they are somewhat embittered for being thus assigned, though it is impossible to know, for they rarely speak at all. I have several times referred to them as my unholy trinity in jest, but this is yet to produce in them a single smile. They are a deadly serious lot, which, I suppose, makes them well suited to the task of keeping me alive." Mary and the children were told that the men were campaign volunteers, who'd come to ward off overeager supporters. It was a plausible explanation. Abe had become quite famous, and the Lincoln's home was beset by well-wishers and favor-seekers at all hours. But vampire bodyguards were only one of the secrets honest old Abe kept from his wife and adoring public that summer. He'd also scraped the rust off his axe. And, for the first time, his target was a living man. "Abraham, I must ask one more errand of you. He is one of your kind, but is looked after by two of mine at all times. Take every caution." Abe nearly gasped when he saw the name below. Jefferson Davis. There was hardly a more accomplished Southern politician in America. Davis had graduated from West Point, fought valiantly in the Mexican-American War, served as governor of Mississippi, served in Franklin Pierce's cabinet, and been twice elected to the Senate. He was an outspoken pro-slavery advocate, and, as a former Secretary of War, the man best suited to lead the South against the better-armed, more populous North. This time, Abe refused to go. "Henry, I am an old man with three sons and a wife who has wept over too many graves already. I will cause her no further grief by getting myself killed. Surely there are 100 or 1,000 among your kind better suited to the task. Why must you prevail upon me when I am years removed from my best? Send someone else. Yours, Abraham." Henry's reply came by express a mere 4 days after Abe sent his refusal off to New York. "Abraham, it is a difficult thing to know the future. We see it reflected as in ripples of water, distorted and ever-moving. There are moments, however, when the ripples subside and the reflection becomes clear. The Union saw one of those moments in your future that night in New York. You are destined to defeat Jefferson Davis, Abraham. You alone. Further, I do not believe that it is your destiny to die on this errand. I feel this with my whole self. I would not send you otherwise. It must be you, Abraham. I beg you reconsider. Ever, H. Abe was 52 years old, and while he remained remarkably agile for his age, he was a far cry from the young hunter who could split a log from 50 yards. He needed backup. I have sent word to Speed to meet me in Springfield at once, and, after a great deal of consideration, I have brought Layman to the truth as well. He thought me either round the bend or a damned lying fool when I first revealed the story of vampires and their evil designs on man, and very nearly lost his temper, until I prevailed upon one of the Trinity to confirm my story, which he did in dramatic fashion. There are few men who can be trusted in this war, and though Layman and I disagree on a great many things, slavery being not the least of them, he has proven himself a loyal friend. With Jack gone, enlisting a man of his size seems prudent, particularly when Speed is so slight, and I am getting on in years. My God, I feel rather like King Henry at Harfleur. Footnote. A reference to Shakespeare's Henry V, in Act 3, Scene 1, King Henry delivers a rousing speech to his troops, beginning with the famous, "Once more unto the breach, dear friends, once more." In July, the three hunters traveled by train to Bolivar County, Mississippi, where, Abe had been told, Jefferson Davis was recovering after undergoing eye surgery. Concealed in their luggage was a traveling armory of revolvers, knives, crossbows, and Abe's axe, newly sharpened, glistening once again. Candidate Lincoln had spent days secretly whittling new stakes for his quiver and fashioning a new chest plate to wear beneath his coat. He'd retreated to the woods with his axe and practiced throwing it into tree trunks 10, then 20 yards distant. He'd even dusted off his old martyr recipe and prepared a new batch. I insisted that the Trinity remain in Springfield to look after my family. It was a simple errand, I told them. Our target was merely a living man, after all, one rendered infirm and half-blind by surgery. Speed, Layman, and I were more than capable of dispensing with Davis and his vampire minders. The hunters tied up their horses on the edge of Davis's property, just after 1 o'clock in the morning on Monday, July 30th. They kept their distance from the main house, lying in the surrounding woods for a watchful half hour, whispering occasionally, waiting in the faint light of a cloud-covered moon. Abe had received a second letter from Henry before they departed Springfield, a letter bearing new intelligence. The Union spies had learned that Davis was confined to a bedroom on the west side of the second floor. Intent on giving him peace while he healed, his wife, Verena, had taken to sleeping in an adjacent room with their two infant sons and 5-year-old daughter. At night, Davis's two minders took turns patrolling the grounds while the other remained in the house. I thought it strange, therefore, that we saw no sign of such patrols or lights burning in any of the windows. Henry's instructions, however, were precise, and we had traveled a long way. There could be no thoughts of turning back. Satisfied that we had waited long enough, we readied our weapons and crept into the clearing around the two-story house. It was white, or yellow, I could not tell, in the dark, with a raised front porch and first story, as these parts were often deluged when the Mississippi swelled beyond its banks. I half expected to see a vampire waiting at the front door, long since alerted to our presence by the distant whinnying of our horses, the scent of the martyrs in my coat. But there was nothing, only stillness. Doubts flooded my mind as we climbed the steps to the porch. Did I still possess the strength to best a vampire? Had I prepared Layman to face an opponent of such speed and strength? Was Speed still equal to the task at hand? Indeed, the axe in my hands felt heavier than it had since I was a child. Abe slowly nudged the front door as Layman took aim, ready to shoot the vampire that was almost certainly going to leap out of the shadows the moment it was opened. None did. We entered, I with my axe held high, Speed looking down the barrel of his 44 caliber rifle, Layman with a revolver in each hand. We searched the dark, sparsely furnished first floor, our every step announced by creaking floorboards as we went. If indeed there was a vampire guarding Davis above, he knew we were here now. Finding no sign of the dead or living below, we returned to the front of the house and its narrow staircase. Abe led the way up. There were vampires here. He could feel it. I could see the next several moments unfold in my mind as I climbed the stairs. Upon reaching the top, one of the vampires would spring from hiding and strike from my right side. I would turn my axe in his direction and lodge it in his chest as we met. But in doing so, I would be knocked backward, and the two of us would be sent tumbling down the stairs. As we wrestled, the second vampire would strike Speed and Layman above. Layman would panic, this being his first hunt, and empty his revolvers wildly, but his bullets would miss the mark. It would therefore fall to Speed and his rifle to silence the creature, which he would do by shooting it cleanly through the heart and head. The noise would rouse Mrs. Davis and the children from sleep, and they would scurry into the hall at precisely the moment I freed my axe from the first vampire's chest and took his head at the base of the staircase. Their screams would bring the frail, half-blind Jefferson Davis stumbling out of his own bedroom, upon which Speed and Layman would shoot him to death. With our sincere apologies to his family, we would then run off into the night. But on reaching the top of the stairs, Abe found nothing. Every door was open, every room empty. Could we be in the wrong place? Could Davis have suddenly and inexplicably risen from his bed and departed for Washington? No. Henry's instructions had been meticulous. This was the house. This was the intended date and time of our strike. It was all wrong. There are vampires here. I can feel it. The truth now formed in my mind. Oh, that I had ignored my instincts. That I had come at all. Damn Henry's rippling water. How could I have been so reckless? How could I have ventured my life with three sons at home? A wife who was already fragile from grief? No, I would not die tonight. I refused. Out, whispered Abe. Out at once, and make ready your weapons. We are betrayed. We bounded down the stairs toward the front door, but on reaching it found it locked from the outside. The clapping of wood against wood now surrounded us as storm shutters were slammed shut over every window, and a chorus of hammers pounded nails into the house, ensuring they could not be opened. Upstairs, I cried. But here, too, the shutters had been closed and fastened. They've trapped us, said Layman. Yes, said Speed. However, all things being equal, I'd rather be in here with us than out there with them. Abe said nothing. He knew it wouldn't be long before they smelled the smoke, before they felt the heat of the fire as it ate through the walls and floorboards. As if answering this thought, Layman exclaimed, Look! And pointed to the flickering orange light coming through the crack beneath the front door. They had no choice. Whatever horrors waited outside, they couldn't be worse than certain death by burning. The flames were now visible all around them through the slats in the storm shutters. I had a plan. Once through the door, we would remain shoulder to shoulder, three across, and charge straight ahead until we reached the tree line. I would take the center, using my axe to cut down whatever came at us from the front. Speed and Layman would be on my right and left, shooting whatever came at us from the sides. It was a plan almost certain to fail, based on how quickly the shutters had closed around us. There were at least a dozen men, vampires, or some combination of the two outside, but it was the only one we had. I lifted my axe and steadied myself. Gentlemen, I said. The front door flew open with a single blow of Abe's axe, sending smoke and hot ash flying away from the porch. The heat was immediate. It drove us back at first, blistering our skin and very nearly setting our clothes alight. When my eyes adjusted to the flames on the front porch, by now fully engulfed, I saw that the fallen door had provided a narrow path across. I held my breath and led the way, hurrying over the door, down the front steps and onto the grass below. No sooner had my feet touched the ground than I realized the hopelessness of our effort, for in the light of the burning house behind us, I discerned no fewer than 20 figures ahead, some aiming rifles, others wearing dark glasses to shield their eyes from the flames, living men and vampires, conspiring to cut off all hope of escape. One of the living, an older gentleman, stepped forward and stood but 10 feet from me. "Mr. Lincoln, I presume," he said. "Mr. Davis," said Abe. "I'd be much obliged," said Davis, "if your companions would put those irons down. I'd hate for one of my men to startle and fill the three of you with holes." Abe turned to Speed and Layman and gave a nod. Both dropped their guns. "The big one's concealing another pistol," said one of the vampires behind Davis. "He's thinking about reaching for it right now." "Well, if he does," said Davis, "then I suggest you kill him." Davis turned back to Abe. "Your axe as well, if you please." "If it's all the same, Mr. Davis," said Abe, "I don't expect to live but a few moments longer, and I would very much like to die holding the axe my daddy gave me as a boy. Surely one of your men will shoot me if I raise it in anger." Davis smiled. "I like you, Mr. Lincoln. I do. Kentucky born, same as me. Self-made. As fine an orator as ever lived. And dedicated, my lord. Coming all the way down here just to kill a man. Leaving your family alone and unprotected in Springfield. No, sir. Let no man speak ill of your convictions. I could sing your praises till morning, sir. But some of my associates are rather sensitive to sunlight, and, well, I'm afraid we just don't have that long." "Tell me," said Davis, "with your many fine qualities and famous mind, how is it that you've arrived on the wrong side of this fight?"
"I?" asked Abe. "I must have misheard you, sir, for of the two of us, only one is conspiring against his fellow man."
"Mr. Lincoln, vampires are superior to man, just as man is superior to the Negro. It's the natural order of things, you see. Surely we agree on this much, at least."
"I agree that some vampires are superior to some men."
"Am I wrong, therefore, to recognize the inevitability of their rule? Am I wrong to side with the greater power in the coming war? Sir, it brings me no pleasure to think of white men in cages, but if it must come to pass, if vampires are to be the kings of men, then let us work with them while time remains. Let us regulate the thing, limit it to the Negro, and to the undesirables of our own race."
"Ah," said Abe, "and when the blood of Negroes is no longer sufficient, when the undesirables of our race have been exhausted, tell me, Mr. Davis, who then shall your kings feed upon?"
Davis said nothing.
"America," Abe continued, "was forged in the blood of those who oppose tyranny. You and your allies, would you not see it delivered into the hands of tyrants?"
"America is that-a-way, Mr. Lincoln," laughed Davis, pointing north. "You're in Mississippi now."
He stepped forward to the very edge of where Abe's axe could reach if he chose to swing it.
"And let us speak plainly, sir. We're both the servants of vampires. But when these hostilities are at an end, I will be left to enjoy the peace of my remaining years in comfort and wealth, and you will be dead. And there it is."
Davis paused a moment, offered a slight bow, and retreated. Three of the living men now stepped to the front of the group, each with a rifle aimed at us, each waiting for Davis to give the order.
"Damn it, Abe," said Layman. "Are we just going to stand here and do nothing?"
"I'm wearing a watch," Speed told the executioners, his voice cracking. "It belonged to my grandfather. I ask only that someone see it back to my wife in Louisville."
These are the last seconds of my life.
Well, if I'm dying, said Layman, I'm dying with a gun in my hand. He reached for his coat.
Boys, said Abe to his friends, I'm sorry for dragging you into the...
The crack of rifles filled the night before he could finish.
In that instant, I saw the faces of all those loved ones departed from this earth. My dear, sweet little boy, my sturdy Armstrong and beloved Anne. I saw my sister and my angel mother. But when this instant passed and my eyes remembered themselves, my executioners remained in the light of the burning house, shock on their faces. Speed and Layman remained standing on either side of me. We still lived. Our executioners, however, were not as fortunate. All three fell in unison, bullets having torn through their skulls. It was a miracle. That miracle was Henry Sturgis. He charged out of the dark with 11 Union vampires on his heels. Some held rifles, others revolvers, firing as they came. The southern vampires nearest Davis hurried him off, while the others prepared to meet their northern counterparts. One of them, however, remembered that the job of my execution remained unfinished. He leapt at me from 20 yards distant, fangs and claws extended, eyes black behind his dark glasses. I let my axe fly, and the blade found its target, but my strength, not being what it once was, it failed to sink more than an inch or two into his middle. He fell back briefly and looked at the dark ribbons pouring from the gash in his belly. They were of no concern. He picked my axe off the ground and came at me again. I thrust a hand into my coat, looking for a knife that had not been there in 20 years, helpless. With the vampire not 4 feet from me, Layman aimed over my shoulder and fired, forever diminishing the hearing in my left ear, but silencing the creature with a bullet through the face. As the smoke from Layman's revolver hung in the air around his head, Abe became aware of a sharp pain coming from his chin. I pressed my hand to it. The vampire had come close enough to open a gash with the tip of my axe. Blood dripped from the wound and down the front of my shirt as vampires clashed before us in the light of the flames, jumping impossible distances, crashing into each other with enough force to shake the ground beneath our feet. Here, for the first time, I saw Henry Sturgis in battle. I watched him run headlong into a southern vampire and drive the devil into a tree, the result being that its trunk split in two. Yet Henry's opponent was hardly affected, for he pushed back and began to swing wildly with his hands, as if holding a sword in each. Henry defended each of these strikes with his own clawed hands, until, being the better swordsman of the two, he saw an opportunity and ran his opponent through the middle, forcing 5 straightened fingers into the vampire's belly and out his back, snapping his spine in the process. Henry withdrew his hand, and his opponent fell to the ground, unable to move. I watched him twist the vampire's head backward and rip it from his shoulders. The living men, unfortunate enough to find themselves in the middle of this melee, were torn apart, their limbs taken by errant claws, their bones crushed by the force of the vampires colliding around them. Realizing that the numbers were not in their favor, the remaining southern vampires made a hasty retreat. Several Union vampires gave chase. The others, including Henry, hurried to meet us where we stood. Abraham, he said, I'm pleased to see you alive, old friend.
And I to see you dead.
Henry smiled. He tore a sleeve from his shirt and held it to Abe's chin to slow the bleeding, while his companions attended to Layman and Speed, who were shaken up but otherwise unharmed.
The Union had been given false information by a traitorous spy, information meant to lure me to my death. Henry and his allies did not learn of this treachery until after we left Springfield. With no means of getting word to us, for we traveled under false names, they rode for 2 days and nights to head us off, while sending word to the Trinity to have Mary and the boys placed in hiding.
"And you're sure they're safe?" asked Abe. "I'm sure they're in hiding, and protected by 3 of my most cunning, most vicious allies," said Henry. It would suffice. Abe knew that the Trinity took their work seriously.
"Henry," he said after a long pause, "I was certain that I was going to. I told you, Abraham, it wasn't your time. It would be the last hunt of Abe's life."
On November 6, 1860, Abe sat in a cramped telegraph office in Springfield. The tide of well-wishers and appointment seekers had risen to unbearable levels as the election approached. "When the 6th came at last, I declared that I wished to see no one until all the votes were in. My only company was to be the young telegraph operator. If the outcome was the one I and my supporters expected, there would be few peaceful days in the coming years." He'd grown a beard for the first time in his life to conceal the scar on his chin. Footnote: it's widely believed that Abe got the idea to grow a beard from 11-year-old Grace Bedell. While it's true that Bedell wrote with the suggestion, insisting that ladies like whiskers, and would therefore urge their husbands to vote for him, he'd already begun to grow it by the time her famous letter arrived. It gave his face a fuller, healthier appearance. More distinguished, as Mary said, a face befitting the next president. Mary was, at first, quite opposed to my running, having not enjoyed her previous time in Washington, and being all too aware of the time such an endeavor would require of me. As my campaign met with increasing success, however, her position began to change. I suspect that she rather enjoyed the well-wishers who came to our door at all hours, the wealthy couples who invited us to their homes for dinner, and the lavish events thrown in my honor. I suspect that she began to see the many social possibilities of being married to the President of the United States. As the returns began to trickle in over the telegraph wires that Tuesday evening, it seemed more and more certain that Abe would be just that. I admit it came as little surprise, for I believed that the Union would see to my victory, whether earned or not. Footnote: there was no cause for the Union to intervene. Abe comfortably won the election on his own merits. I could therefore feel none of the honor that had accompanied my being elected captain by my fellow soldiers. The weight of the thing was immense, the challenges and miseries ahead unknowable and numerous. Henry's telegram had been one of the first to arrive that morning, long before a single vote had been counted. "Congratulations, Mr. President. Ever. H." 4. President-elect Abraham Lincoln's journey to the White House began in Springfield on February 11, 1861. A private train was ordered to shepherd Abe, his family, his close associates, and his private security detail to Washington, D.C. It hadn't been an easy transition. Just over a month after the election, South Carolina's legislature voted to secede from the Union. One by one, more southern states followed, seven in all by Inauguration Day: Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, and Texas. Abe could only watch as President Buchanan did nothing to stem the crisis. "Buchanan continues to rest on his rump as the country comes apart, as the ships of our Navy and forts are daily surrendered to the South, and the Union dissolves before our eyes. His weakness astonishes. It seems clear that he has decided to kick this crisis down the road. I, on the other hand, am very much looking forward to kicking him onto Pennsylvania Avenue." 3 days before Abe's train left Springfield, the self-proclaimed leaders of the Southern people met in Montgomery, Alabama, to formally adopt a constitution and announce the Confederate States of America. They chose Jefferson Davis as their president. Abe's Trinity patrolled the train day and night. Officially, they were detectives from Springfield who'd volunteered to look after the new president. His security detail also included a pair of humans, a detective named Alan Pinkerton and his old friend Ward Hill Lehman. Lehman had volunteered to be Abe's bodyguard out of nothing more than friendly concern for his safety. He was one of the few around the new president who knew the gravity of the threats he faced. In the coming years, White House staff would grow used to seeing Lehman patrol the White House grounds after dark, or sleeping in front of the door to the president's bedroom. He was big, tough, handy with a gun, and fiercely loyal, and his help was desperately needed. Abe's train was scheduled to stop in at least 10 major cities on the way to Washington. In each one, thousands, if not tens of thousands, of locals came in hopes of seeing the new president with their own eyes. Abe would often make an impromptu speech from the rear car, sometimes only inches from those who'd packed in to hear him speak. He would then leave the stations by coach to meet with local leaders, attend banquets, or watch parades in his honor. It was a security nightmare.
"It has been an overwhelming several days. The boys are in fine spirits, though, running about the train, watching the country roll by through its windows. Bob finds it all so very exciting, while Willie and Tad seem not the least bit affected by the crowds, or by the presence of so many new faces. Mary, too, seems to be taking it all in stride, though her head has been especially bothersome this trip."
Footnote: Mary suffered from debilitating headaches, possibly migraines, throughout her adult life. Many historians suggest they were related to her famous bouts of depression. Some even suggest that she was schizophrenic, though it is impossible to know. For all the excitement, there was a conspicuous tension hanging over the train. Everyone on board felt it, though no one spoke of it openly.
"There are some who have sworn that I shall never live to see the White House. Such talk breeds grave concern, an appropriate kind given the subject, on the faces of my protectors. I, however, can honestly say that it cost me not one nickel of sleep, for I have known death my entire life, and have come to regard him as something of an old friend. Of course, Mary is roused to great anxiety by these rumors, but then she is roused to great anxiety by a great many things. So long as our boys hear nothing of it, I am content."
The trip continued without incident for 10 days, through Indiana, Ohio, New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. And it began to seem that all of the talk of assassination was just that. But on February 22nd in Philadelphia, Abe received an urgent visit from William Seward's son, Frederick. He came bearing a sealed letter.
"Dear Mr. President-elect, our mutual acquaintance wishes it known that a plot has been discovered in Baltimore. 4 men will stab and shoot you to death when you change trains at the Calvert Street station. He thought it best you should be aware of this, so that you may take every precaution against it. Yours, William Seward."
It was decided that Abe, accompanied by Pinkerton and Lehman, and wearing a hat and cloak to conceal his identity from the other passengers, would take a separate train through Baltimore directly to Washington. Pinkerton and Lehman would be armed. Abe wouldn't.
"This caused quite a squabble, I recall. Lehman, who knew me to be proficient with such weapons, insisted I be given a revolver and a long knife. Pinkerton refused. 'I will not have it said that the future president of the United States entered the Capitol armed.' The two nearly came to blows over the matter, until I offered a compromise. Lehman would carry 2 of each weapon and would give them over only if we came under attack. It was agreed to, and we prepared to be off."
But their plans changed when Pinkerton realized that the Trinity was gone.
"They had simply vanished somewhere between Philadelphia and Harrisburg, giving no reason for their absence. As I refused to leave Mary and the boys without an armed escort, it was quickly decided that Pinkerton would stay behind and look after them, while Lehman accompanied me on the other train. The telegraph lines between Pennsylvania and Maryland were then cut, so that any conspirators would be unable to relay word of our departure from Harrisburg."
Just after midnight on the 23rd, Abe's secret train passed through Baltimore on its way to Washington.
"There were anxious moments as we passed through the heart of the city,
more slowly, it seemed, than any train I had ever ridden on. Could these assassins have discovered our trick? Were they at this very moment preparing to bombard our train with cannon fire? Abe needn't have worried. By the time his train rolled through the station, three of his would-be assassins were already dead, and the fourth was dying beneath his feet. The partial bodies of four men were found near Calvert Street Station the next morning. From the February 23rd edition of the Baltimore Sun. Two gentlemen have had their heads taken. Another has been viciously beaten, to the extent that police are as yet unable to determine his age or race. The fourth, it seems, was halved beneath the wheels of a passing locomotive. Incredibly, a witness claims that the gentleman survived for several minutes thereafter, his spine being severed in such a way that he was still able to move his head and arms. He was seen faintly crying out and attempting to drag his remaining body from the tracks before dying. Though they never spoke a word about the incident, Abe never doubted that his three vampire protectors had been responsible for the carnage. 5. On March 4, 1861, Abraham Lincoln, exceptional boy of Sinking Springs Farm, apple of his departed mother's eye, survivor of the trials of Job, and one of the nation's most accomplished vampire hunters, was sworn in as the 16th President of the United States. "We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection, the mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature." Tens of thousands gathered in front of a covered wooden platform on the Capitol steps to hear him speak. Little did they know that they were witnessing the largest security operation in history. Troops were stationed around the city, ready to put down any violent protests or large-scale attacks. Police, both uniformed and not, stood guard beneath the podium where Abe spoke, keeping an eye out for anyone who might raise a revolver or long rifle. Closer to the president-elect, Ward Hill Lehman hovered on the platform with two revolvers in his coat and a long knife on his belt. The vampires of the Trinity were stationed at different points, but they were never far from Abe. Only later would I learn that the hearts of two armed men had been discreetly run through during my speech. Unlike the assassins in Baltimore, these had been vampires. 5 weeks into Abe's young presidency, the country's strained bonds of affection finally broke. Fort Sumter, a federal stronghold in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina, had been under siege by Confederates since January. The Southerners demanded that the Union troops, commanded by Major Robert Anderson, surrender the fort, as it was in South Carolina, and therefore not the property of the federal government. Abe had done everything in his power to prevent hostilities from breaking out, but Anderson's men were running desperately short of food, and the only way to resupply them was by sending warships into Confederate territory. "I am now forced to choose between two evils. Either I must allow a few soldiers to starve, or provoke a war that will undoubtedly kill scores of soldiers. Struggle as I might, I can see no third option." Abe sent the ships. The first of them reached Charleston Harbor on April 11th. The next morning, before sunrise, Confederate Colonel James Chestnut, Jr. gave the order to fire on the fort. It was the first shot of the Civil War. 11. Casualties. "Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. We of this Congress and this administration will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare one or another of us. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down, in honor or dishonor, to the latest generation.
Abraham Lincoln in a message to Congress, December 1, 1862. 1. On June 3, 1861, Stephen A. Douglas was found dead in a stairwell of his Chicago home. I have just this hour heard the shocking news. Though the full facts have not yet come to light, I have no doubt that it is the work of vampires, and that I bear some of the responsibility for his murder. Publicly, the cause of death was reported as typhoid fever, even though none of Douglas's friends remembered him feeling unwell the night before he was discovered. The body was taken by coach to Mercy Hospital, where it was examined by a young Chicago physician, Dr. Bradley Milliner. From the autopsy report, 4 small circular puncture wounds on deceased's body, 2 on left shoulder, directly over axillary artery, 2 the neck, directly over right common carotid artery. Both sets surrounded by significant bruising, uniformly spaced 1 1/2 inches apart. Whole of deceased's body badly decayed and gray-blue in color. Face is sunken, skin brittle, suggesting death occurred weeks or months before examination. Stomach contains brightly colored whole pieces of undigested food, suggesting deceased ate shortly before death and that death occurred less than 24 hours before examination. Along with his observations, Dr. Milliner scribbled a single word in the report's margin: incredible. The report itself was deemed inconclusive and suppressed by Milliner's superiors, who thought that releasing such information would only add to the climate of conjecture and suspicion surrounding the senator's death. Footnote: the report was thought lost in the Great Chicago Fire of 1871 until it was discovered during a renovation of Mercy Hospital in 1967. On the day the news went public, Mercy received an anonymous donation of $1 million. The day after that, the report was declared a hoax by hospital officials. Lincoln and Douglas had been the most famous rivals in America. For 2 decades, they'd competed over everything from a woman's love to the highest office in the land. But for all their political antipathy, the two had grown to respect, even like each other over the years. Douglas was, after all, one of Abe's brilliant beacons in Washington's fog of fools. And while the so-called little giant spent years appealing to Southern passions, he was, in his heart, no son of the South. In fact, Douglas loathed the idea of disunion, going so far as to call secessionists criminals and declaring, "We must fight for our country and forget our differences. There can be but 2 parties, the party of patriots and the party of traitors. We belong to the first." When the Union began to tear itself apart in the wake of his failed 1860 campaign, it was Stephen Douglas who first reached out to his old rival, the new president-elect. "He wishes to join me in the cause of opposing secession. To that end, I have asked him to make a speaking tour of the border states in the Northwest, those places where the flame of unity might yet be fanned by our efforts, or snuffed out by a lack of them. I can think of no better messenger, no ally more symbolic, of the need for unity. I will admit that his offer took me quite by surprise. I suppose it possible that he has come to regret his association with the vampire South, and is looking for some means of redemption. Whatever his reasons, I welcome his help." Douglas made pro-Union speeches in 3 states before returning to Washington. At Abe's inauguration, with the threat of assassination hanging in the air, he placed himself near the podium and declared, "If any man attacks Lincoln, he attacks me." And on Sunday, April 14, 1861, as Fort Sumter was being surrendered to the Confederates, Stephen Douglas was among the first to race to the White House. "He came today with no appointment, only to find that I was meeting with the cabinet, and would thus be engaged for quite some time. Presidential Secretary John Nicolay
asked him to call again, but Judge Douglas flatly refused. When I had grown weary of hearing his familiar baritone shouting profanities in the hall, I swung my office door open and exclaimed, "By God, let the man in, or we shall have two wars to fight." We met privately for an hour or more. I had never seen him in such a panicked state. "They will march headlong into Washington and kill me," he cried. "Kill the lot of us. I demand to know what plans you have to combat this menace, sir." I told him, in the calmest voice I could muster, the truth, that I was to call for 75,000 militia the next morning, that I was to suppress this rebellion with every power of my office and weapon in my arsenal. These reassurances, however, only seemed to deepen his panic. He urged me to call for 3 times that number. "Mr. President," he said, "you do not know the dishonest purposes of those men as I do. You do not, and I say this with the deepest respect, sir, know the real enemy you face." "Oh, but I assure you, Mr. Douglas, I know them too well." Thanks to Henry, Abe had known about Douglas's connection to Southern vampires since their Senate race 3 years earlier. Douglas, however, never suspected that the gangly, graying man before him had once been the mightiest vampire hunter on the Mississippi. I can scarcely describe his astonishment at hearing the word vampires pass my lips. Now, with the truth out at last, each of us told the other his story. I of my mother's death, of my years spent hunting vampires. Douglas of the fateful day when, as a young, ambitious Democrat in the Illinois state legislature, he was approached by a pair of sallow men from the South. "It was then that I first learned of vampires," he said. "It was then that I first became intoxicated by their money and influence." Douglas repaid their support by railing against abolitionists in the Senate and by using his natural talent for speechmaking to rally pro-slavery forces across the country. But he'd begun to question his vampire patrons in recent years. "Why do they reject compromise with the North?" he asked. "Why do they seem intent on war at any cost? And why, by God, do they care so fervently for the institution of slavery at all? I could see no logic in it, and I could not, in good conscience, continue down the path to disunion." It became clear that Douglas did not know the whole truth, clear that, while guilty of some small treachery, he could not be judged with the likes of the traitorous Jefferson Davis. Moved by his remorse, I determined to tell him all. The marriage of slavery and Southern vampires. Their plan to enslave all but the fortunate few of our kind, to keep us in cages and chains as we had kept the Negro. I told him of their plan to create a new America, a nation of vampires, free from oppression, free from darkness, and blessed with an abundance of living men to feast upon. By the time I finished speaking, Douglas wept. That night, Abe sat at the head of a long table in his office, with Secretary of State William Seward to his left. They were joined by the rest of the cabinet, all of them anxious to hear why they'd been summoned from their supper tables and rushed back to the White House. "Gentlemen," I said at last, "I wish to speak to you this evening about vampires." Abe had met with his cabinet on a near daily basis since the inauguration. They'd discussed every detail of the coming war: uniforms, supply lines, commanders, horses, provisions, everything but the truth of what they were really fighting for and who they were really fighting against. "And yet, I had asked these men to plan me a war. Was it not akin to asking a group of blind men to pilot a steamboat?" The encounter with Douglas had changed Abe's mind. When they parted company that evening, he had ordered Nicolay to reconvene the cabinet at once. "I thought it crucial that these men who were to be my counsel through untold miseries, knew exactly what they faced. There would be no more revelations in this office, no more half-truths or omissions. Now, just as I had with Douglas, I would tell them the whole truth, with Seward there to endorse every word of it. My history, my hunting, my alliance with a small band of vampires called the Union, and the unthinkable consequences of the coming war. Some were shocked to hear vampires spoken of at all. Secretary of the Navy Gideon Wells and Secretary of the Treasury Salmon Chase, it seemed, had managed to go the whole of their lives thinking them nothing more than myth. Wells sat in ashen silence. Chase, however, grew indignant. "I will not stand for folly in the face of war," he declared. "I will not be summoned from my home to be made a fool for the president's amusement." Seward rose to my defense, insisting that every word was true, and admitting his own complicity in keeping it from the rest of the cabinet. Chase remained unconvinced. He was not alone in his doubts. Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, who had long believed vampires real, but confined to the shadows, was the next to speak. "What sense can it make?" he asked. "Why would Jefferson Davis, why would any man conspire against himself? Why would any man hasten his own enslavement?" "Davis has only his own survival in mind," I said. "He and his allies are pilot fish, cleaning the teeth of sharks to avoid being themselves bitten. Perhaps they have been promised power and riches in this new America, exemption from chains. But know this, whatever they have been promised is a lie." Chase could bear it no longer. He rose from his seat and left the room. I waited for others to join him. Satisfied that none would, I continued. "Even now," I said, "there is a part of me that finds it all impossible to believe, a part of me that expects to wake from a half-century's dream. Even after all these years and all the things I have witnessed, and why not? After all, to believe in vampires is to reject reason, to acknowledge a darkness that is not supposed to exist anymore. Not here in this great age, where science has illuminated all but a few mysteries. No, no, that darkness belongs in the Old Testament, in the tragedies of Shakespeare, but not here. That, gentlemen, that is why they thrive. That belief, that we live beyond the reach of darkness, is one that vampires have worked tirelessly to instill through the centuries. I submit to you that it is nothing less than the greatest lie ever sold to mankind." 2. 3 days after the fall of Fort Sumter, Virginia seceded from the Union, and the Confederate capital was relocated to its industrial heart, Richmond. Over the next few weeks, Arkansas, Tennessee, and North Carolina followed. There were now 11 states in the Confederacy, with a combined population of 9 million people, 4 million of which were slaves. Even so, most Northerners were convinced that the war would be a short one, and that the Setchers, secessionists, would be stamped out by summer's end. They had reason to be confident. The North, after all, had more than twice the population of the South. It had railroads that could speed troops and provisions to the battlefield in a fraction of the time, superior factories to supply boots and ammunition, warships to blockade ports and pound coastal cities. Pro-Union newspapers urged the president to bring about a swift end to this unpleasantness. Cries of "Forward to Richmond" were heard across the North. Henry Sturgis agreed. In a telegram dated July 15th, he used a quote from Shakespeare to send Abe a coded message: "Strike Richmond now." Footnote. For fear of spies, all of Henry's wartime messages to Abe were coded in one way or another. "Abraham, in God's name, cheerly on, courageous friends to reap the harvest of perpetual peace, by this one bloody trial of sharp war." H. Footnote. Spoken by the character Richmond in Richard III, Act 5, Scene 2. Abe followed the advice. The day after receiving the letter, he ordered the largest fighting force ever assembled on North American soil, 35,000 men, to march from Washington to Richmond under the command of Brigadier General Irvin McDowell. Most of McDowell's soldiers came from the 75,000 militiamen hurriedly called up in the wake of Fort Sumter. They were, for the most part, farmers and tradesmen, baby-faced teenagers and frail old men. Some had never fired a shot in their lives. McDowell complains that his men are inexperienced. "You are green," I told him, "but the Confederates are green also. You are all green alike. We must not wait for the enemy to come marching into Washington. We must meet him where he lives. To Richmond, by God." To get there, McDowell and his men would have to march 25 miles south into Virginia, where General Pierre Beauregard and 20,000 Confederates were waiting for them. In the sweltering heat of Monday, July 21, 1861, the two armies met near the town of Manassas. It would be remembered as the First Battle of Bull Run, so named for the little creek that would soon run red. 2 days after the battle, a Union private named Andrew Murrow wrote home to his new bride in Massachusetts. Footnote: Murrow's letter, housed in the Harvard University archives, has long been mistaken for a work of epistolary fiction. His letter paints a gruesome picture of the day's events and offers some of the earliest evidence that the Confederate Army had vampires in its ranks. "We had the Confederates whipped at the start. Blessed with greater numbers, we drove the devil south up Henry House Hill and into a group of trees at its peak. What a sight to see them scatter like mice, to see our ranks spread half a mile wide, to hear the cracking of gunpowder from all directions." "Let us chase them all the way to Georgia," cried Colonel Hunter, to the delight of the men. "As we neared the top of the hill, the rebels covered their retreat by firing on us. The gun smoke grew so thick that one could scarcely see 10 yards into the trees where they hid. From behind this curtain of smoke suddenly came a chorus of wild yells, the voices of 20 or 30 men, growing louder by the moment. 'First ranks, fix bayonets,' ordered the colonel. As they did, a small band of Confederates emerged from the smoke, running toward us as fast as any men have ever run. Even from a distance, I could see their strange, wild eyes. There was not a rifle or a pistol or a sword among them. Melissa, I shall swear until my grave that I saw bullets strike these men in their chests, in their limbs and faces. Yet they continued to charge as if they had not been hit at all. The rebels smashed into our ranks and tore men apart all in front of my eyes. I do not mean to suggest that they ran them through with bayonets or fired on them with revolvers. I mean to say that these rebels, these 30 unarmed men, tore 100 men to pieces with nothing more than their bare hands. I saw arms pulled off, heads twisted backward. I saw blood pour from the throats and bellies of men gutted by mere fingertips, a boy grasping at the holes where his eyes had been a moment before. A private, 3 yards in front of me, had his rifle plucked away. I was close enough to feel his blood on my face as its stock was used to smash his skull in. Close enough to taste his death on my tongue. Our lines broke. I am not ashamed to say that I dropped my rifle and ran with the others, Melissa. The rebels gave chase, overtaking and savaging men on either side of me as we retreated, their screams following me down the hill." Reports of similar rebel charges poured in from McDowell's commanders.
"Well," he is rumored to have said on learning that the Union was in full retreat, "we brought the superior army, but it seems they brought the superior men."
McDowell had no idea that those superior men weren't men at all. The fighting lasted a matter of hours. When the gun smoke gave way, more than 1,000 men were dead, another 3,000 severely or mortally wounded. From the diary of Union Major General Ambrose Burnside:
"I rode past a small pond at dusk and saw men washing their wounds in it. The water had turned quite red as a result, but this did not deter the desperate from drinking it when they crawled to its edge. Near this, I saw the body of a rebel boy who had been hit by a shell.
Only his arms, shoulders, and head remained. His eyes open and face expressionless. A group of buzzards was gathered around him, picking at his entrails, pecking at the bits of his brain that had spilled onto the ground. It is a sight that shall never leave me. And yet, I have seen 100 such horrors this day. A man could walk a mile in any direction without his feet touching the ground. Such are the number of bodies. Even as I write this, I hear the screams of the wounded on the air, begging for help, for water. In some cases, begging for death. I have no more fear of hell, for I have this day seen it with my own eyes. The North was in a state of shock and mourning after Bull Run. Had I only listened to Douglas, to McDowell, had I only called for more men and given them more time to train, this war might be over, and the suffering and death of thousands avoided. It is clear now that the South means to compensate for her smaller numbers by sending vampires to the fields of battle. So be it. I have spent a lifetime hunting vampires with my axe. I shall now spend a little while longer hunting them with my army. If this is to be a long and costly struggle, then let us redouble our resolve to win it. Once its shock subsided, the North took a cue from its president and dug its heels in. Men turned out in droves to enlist, and states pledged new regiments and provisions. On July 22, 1861, the day he signed a bill calling for 500,000 new troops, Abraham Lincoln scribbled a prescient thought in his journal. Let us pray now for the future dead. Though we do not yet know their names, we know that there shall be far too many of them. 3. It had been a bitter, frustrating winter for the president and his cabinet. With rivers frozen and roads covered with mud and snow, there was little either army could do but tend its fires and wait for the thaw. On February 9, 1862, his 53rd birthday, Abe was in his office when the first sign of spring came at last. I have just received word of General Ulysses S. Grant's success at Fort Henry in Tennessee. It is a crucial victory for us in the West, and a welcome change from these long months of waiting. Together with the sound of my rascals playing outside, it is a fine Sunday indeed. Rascals Tad and Willie Lincoln, 7 and 10 years old, respectively, were the unquestioned life, some would say scourge, of the White House. The boys spent countless hours running rampant over the mansion and its grounds during the first year of their father's presidency, a fact that aggravated some of Abe's associates to no end, but offered the president a much-needed distraction from the stresses of running a country and a war. The sound of my boys at play is, too often I confess, the only joy between sunrise and sleep. I am therefore too happy to wrestle and chase them about whenever the opportunity presents itself, and regardless of who looks on. Not 1 week ago, Iowa Senator James W. Grimes walked into my office for an appointment, only to find me pinned to the floor by four boys, Tad and Willie holding my legs, Bud and Holly my arms. Footnote: Horatio Bud Nelson Taft Jr. and Halsey Holly Cook Taft were Willie and Tad's best friends. They were often accompanied by their teenage sister, Julia, whom Abe affectionately called a flibbertigibbet. 59 years later, she would write about her memories of Abe and his boys in Tad Lincoln's Father. "Senator," I said, "if you would be kind enough to negotiate the terms of my surrender." Mary thinks it beneath the dignity of a president to gamble so, but were it not for these moments, these tender little pieces of life, I should go mad in a month's time. Abe was a doting, loving father to all three of his boys, but with Robert off at Harvard, where he was guarded by a handful of local men and vampires, and Tad too young and wild to be still, he grew especially fond of Willie. He has an insatiable appetite for books, a love of solving riddles. If there is a fight, he can be counted on to step in and make the peace. Some are eager to point to the similarities between us, but I do not see us so very similar, for Willie has a kinder heart than I, and a quicker mind.
As he celebrated the good news that Sunday afternoon, Abe happened to catch a glimpse of his boys playing on the frost-covered south lawn below his office window.
Tad and Willie were busy holding a court-martial for Jack, as they often did, accusing him of this offense or that.
Footnote: a small soldier doll that had been given to Tad as a gift. He and his brother enjoyed putting the doll through mock court-martials for treason or dereliction of duty, sentencing him to death, burying him, and then repeating the whole process. Abe was once implored by his boys to write a pardon for their toy, which he did happily.
The doll Jack is pardoned by order of the President, A. Lincoln. Not 10 yards from where they played, two young soldiers, not much more than boys themselves, looked after them, both of them shivering, no doubt wondering what they had done to deserve such an assignment.
They were just two of the dozen living guards who patrolled the White House and its grounds around the clock. At Abe's insistence, his wife and children were accompanied by no fewer than two men or one vampire whenever they ventured outdoors. There were no fences between the street and the mansion in 1862. The public was free to roam the grounds, even enter the mansion's first floor. As journalist Noah Brooks wrote, "The multitude, washed or unwashed, always has free egress and ingress." The multitude was not, however, permitted to carry firearms onto the property. At 3:30, a small, bearded man with a rifle was spotted approaching the White House from the direction of Lafayette Square. The sentry assigned to the north entrance leveled his weapon and ordered the man to stop, yelling at the top of his lungs.
"The commotion drew me to the north windows, where I watched the little man continue his approach, a rifle held across his body. Guards came running now from every corner of the grounds, alerted, as we had been, by the repeated shouts of, 'Stop at once or be shot.' Three of these guards came running quite a bit faster than the others, and made straight for the intruder with no fear of being shot. At the sight of their advance, and I suspect their fangs, the little man at last dropped his rifle and raised his hands in the air. He was nonetheless brought violently to the ground, and his pockets searched by laymen while the Trinity held his limbs. I was later told that he seemed frightened, confused. 'He gave me $10, he supposedly said with tears in his eyes. He gave me $10. Only now, with the immediate danger past, did my eyes find two of the several soldiers now forming a circle around the intruder. Abe's heart stopped. They were the same young soldiers who'd been looking after Willie and Tad. His children were alone. The boys had been too engrossed to pay any mind to the shouting or notice their shivering guards running off to investigate it. In this vulnerable moment, they were set upon by a stranger. He, too, might have escaped their notice had the heel of his boot not come down on their doll and brought an end to their game. Willie and Tad looked up to see a man of average height and build standing over them, wearing a long black coat with a scarf.